Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month we're meeting head-on the toughest substance ever made and a clever way to fingerprint the formerly unfingerprintable. Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and with me for this month's Chemistry World are Phil Broadwith, Andrew Turley and Laura Howells.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And to kick us off, you've heard of single carbon-carbon bonds, you've met double bonds, and probably also triple bonds. But no one expected that we might start considering a quadruple carbon bond. Phil?
If you were to draw the molecule C2, you know, with two carbon atoms, then classically, according to the sort of valence bond picture that we're all taught at school, you'd draw two bonds between the carbon.
Well, what about three, if you had, say, acetylene? Because that's a three bonds, isn't it?
Yes, so acetylene, you'd normally have three bonds, but that also has hydrogens bonded on the end. And when you take those hydrogens away, because of the way that we think of electrons being arranged, that kind of ends out being a double bond. That's, again, as I say, in the classical view of bonding. But what Sasson Shaikh and his colleagues at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in Israel have done is kind of take a slightly different view of bonding and kind of looked at what is a bond anyway, because, you know, we draw lines on paper, but what do they actually mean? And they said, well, you know, a carbon atom has four valence electrons, so why can't it make four bonds?
Why indeed? So what did they find?
OK, well, they did some complicated calculations and came up with a model that has three kind of classical bonds in the same way that acetylene would, as we'd said. And then there are two electrons left, and those electrons are arranged in orbitals that point directly out of the ends of the molecule, sort of kind of directly away from each other.
So you'd think that they'd be so far away that they wouldn't actually interact because they'd be pointing away from each other.
Yeah, exactly. But what the calculations that the group has done show is that actually there is an interaction between those two electrons, and they do pair up in a way that gives a lowering in energy of the whole system, so what you could formally call a bond. Admittedly, it's not as strong as a normal single or double bond, but it is about somewhere between 11.6 and 14.8 kilocalories per mole.
So why can't those two electrons sort of pointing outwards from the end of the molecule just be bent round into the middle so that they do talk to each other and establish a proper covalent bond? What's stopping that happening?
The way we kind of think of bonding is through orbitals that are on the atoms overlapping with each other. And those orbitals, because of the way that they're defined through quantum mechanics and whatever, point in very specific directions. So they can only overlap with each other to make bonds if they point in the same direction or if they point towards each other to a certain degree. Now, if you've got two orbitals that point directly out from each other, that can't really happen in the same way as we would normally think about it happening. But what the calculations have shown is that there is still some interaction between those two electrons.
And apart from in itself being an interesting finding, does this fundamentally change how we regard this aspect of chemistry, or are there any other aspects of chemistry which now we're going to have to rethink because of this finding?
In terms of textbook chemistry, nobody says that, you know, you can have quadruple bonds between non-metals at the top end of the periodic table. And to be honest, I don't think we're going to start teaching chemistry at school to include this kind of theory. But if you want to get really into these particular kinds of molecules and really explain their reactivity, then it only really matches up with the experimental data. If you look at a bonding picture which is more like this kind of quadruple bond than the kind of standard double bond that you would see in a textbook.
Indeed. Well, let's stick with carbon and a form which is getting enormous attention increasingly now, graphene. What have you got for us on this aspect, Laura? Sparkly graphene.
Iridescent graphene oxide, really. This is a beautiful looking material which is super hydrophobic. What Yonglei Zhang's group at Xilang University in China have done is taken graphene oxide, so that's the oxidised version of graphene, so it's still a flat sheet, but there are oxygens sort of sticking up from the sheet. And then they've used some lasers to micro-pattern it. So they've put these two lasers beams onto the surface, and that's created an interference pattern, which has made almost sort of like a corrugated sheet of graphene oxide.
So you get almost like pillars sticking up.
Yeah.
And then there are ridges and valleys.
And valleys, exactly. And these ridges and valleys are what gives it the iridescence, which is why we're saying it's so beautiful. But it's also what gives it these super hydrophobic properties. We've talked about that before, how microstructures can do that.
So you put a droplet of water on there.
Yeah.
It's presumably going to balance on the pillars, on the ridges, because the oxygen stuck there, sticking up, is going to interact with the water.
Yeah, so there's an interesting sort of balance here. So the nanostructure means that you're going to get beading, which is the super hydrophobic effect. But because there are still these oxygen atoms sticking up from the surface, there'll be some sort of hydrophilicity, so some sort of hydrogen bonding.
So it's both hydrophobic and hydrophilic all at once.
All at once. And so what you end up getting is little beads of water on a surface. But if you turn the surface upside down, the beads of water stay there.
It stays there. Wow. Apart from being beautiful, what can you do with it? There must be applications for that.
Sure. I mean, obviously, the immediate applications that spring to mind are when you're talking about microfluidics, when you're talking about controlling water or keeping small amounts of water in specific places. Another aspect that they talk about is maybe looking at cell cultures. So if you're trying to do cell cultures and keep your cells in particular areas, then you can start doing interesting things there as well.
Can you turn the effect on and off? Is there any way that you could apply an electrical current to strengthen or weaken the effect?
To flatten it? I don't know, and I'm not sure they've looked at it. But one thing they have started to talk about is that because you've got this structural colour, you could potentially start using the structural colour as some sort of sensor to monitor or detect things, as well as keeping your water in one place.
Because the ridges and patterns produce an interference pattern with light coming in.
Yes, so because you've used lasers and you've made this pattern, which is sort of, I think the ridges are kind of about 2 micrometres apart, so that's similar to the wavelength of light. And so it just works like a diffraction grating. It separates out your light and you get these beautiful colours.
Amazing stuff. Thank you, Laura. For over a century, fingerprints have been helping forensics teams to solve crimes. And they've used a range of techniques, including even superglue vapour, to lift prints from various surfaces. But the results, and the situations that they work under, aren't ideal, which is what made a serendipitous discovery by Loughborough scientist Paul Kelly so exciting.
Well, what we wanted to do was look at the chemistry of this rather strange small molecule, disulfur dinitride, which is rather odd in the sense that it's only got 4 atoms in it. It's in a square ring arrangement. And as you might imagine, for something like that, it's extremely strained and wants to polymerize. And that has been known for many, many decades now, because the polymer that you generate that way actually behaves as a metallic conductor. So we wanted to get into some aspect of this. So we were looking at working with zeolite systems, putting this small molecule within the pores of the zeolite and hoping it would polymerize up. And so therefore we would generate, if you like, a molecular wire within a zeolite system. What we found was that when you were exposing this small molecule to the zeolite systems within one of our vacuum chambers, the little sample vial that you would hold the zeolite in would come out with a fingerprint developed on it. And even though people have been doing fingerprinting for many, many decades, it was still important to try to address some key issues regarding problem media and so on.
So what did the fingerprints that were developing incidentally like this look like?
The polymer itself is dark blue, black in colour. It was pretty obvious what you had straight away. On the glass of the vial, you would see the fingerprint picked out in this dark blue material.
What about if you washed off the glassware? Was it particularly robust and resilient, this signal, or was it relatively easy to perturb the fingerprint?
That depends on what media we're talking about, because the subsequent work that we've done shows that if you were to wash some media beforehand and get rid of the fingerprint before exposing it to S2N2, you don't really get any joy. But what we have shown is that on certain media, particularly metals, there's a corrosion signature left over by the washed-off fingerprint, and so when exposed to S2N2, you will actually get the fingerprint still picked out, even though, paradoxically, it's not actually physically there anymore.
Looking at what's in a fingerprint, there's going to be some sweat there will be some metal ions in the sweat, there will be proteins and there will be fats. So actually, pretty much all aspects of chemistry are open for investigation. It could be anything. But what aspects of the reactivity of the disulfur dinitride could actually be doing this?
Well, it's hard to know because it's an unusual molecule. As I say, it's one that in many ways hasn't been studied in terms of its general chemistry, anything like as much as many other main group systems. It's been studied in the context of polymerizing because, as I say, there's really nice properties to the polymer when you get it. But direct sort of fundamental chemistry studies on it have been fewer and further between, even compared to some related materials such as the tetrasulfur tetranitride. So one problem is it's actually rather difficult to necessarily from first principles fathom what direct chemical interaction you actually could have from this material. The other point to bear in mind, of course, is that when it's reacting or when it's generating an image in a situation where the printer's been removed from a metal surface, then you don't have a chemical reaction happening. You can't do because there is no chemistry there to occur. This must be a physical process on the surface of the metal. And somehow this thing is relating or recognizing the fact that there is a change to the surface of the metal and responding accordingly by polymerizing where the print was, where this small corrosion signature is.
So what can this do that we can't do with traditional existing forensic techniques? What does it add?
There's a couple of things. One that I guess has potential, and that relates to what you might call problem media, but where you actually have extant prints. So where you would have the print is definitely there, some chemical residue of the print is there, but it's on a surface that's actually traditionally very difficult to get prints from. A classic example of that would be cotton or various textiles. And we've had some level of success on that front. But the other thing that it does that is different is it's chemically revealing those removed prints from a metal surface. To the best of my knowledge, there's no chemical technique that can do that at the moment. There are instrumental techniques that allow you to show that that kind of corrosion signature is there. But because this is in the gas phase, you've got the opportunity to expose a large area of maybe a convoluted item in one fell swoop.
So is this actually come to fruition? Are the forensics people taking this technique and now applying it to crime scenes? Or is there tons of regulation and proof of concept to go through yet before you can say this is a done and dusted, excuse the pun, technique?
Well, what we have done is we've had a lot of interaction with people that, for example, what used to be H2SDB, the Home Office Scientific Development branch, but it's now is CAST. We've certainly had the interactions to show what we can do. I mean, one thing that we've been very careful to do thus far, because I think of the synthetic background rather than the forensic background, is to say, well, look, if you do this, this, and this, this happens. In that sense, the ball is then in the forensic people's court. It's them to say, well, okay, that is actually applicable, that's something that we want, that's something that could be usable in the correct circumstance.
Given that you've had this level of success with this rather strange molecule, which you wouldn't have thought would have done this, has this tempted you to take things that are chemically a bit similar and see if you can extend the repertoire of fingerprinting or the sensitivity and so on into a regime or realm that we wouldn't previously have thought would be possible?
I think the answer to that is that there is a moral to the story here, which is that you wouldn't have particularly expected that system to do what it does. And the moral, therefore, is what other main group compounds, what other main group binary systems, for example, could possibly do this, not just in terms of fingerprints, but for other forensic aspects as well. And one problem with that is there's a little bit of a disparity between the forensic community and certainly what you would broadly class as an inorganic chemistry community. They don't particularly talk to each other. So in a sense, if there's something comes from this, aside to the actual technique itself, it might be, hopefully, this idea that there's a bit more of a meeting of minds between those two different communities. There is clearly a crossover possibilities there. There has to be.
Loughborough chemist Paul Kelly. And now to one of the toughest substances ever made, after Laura first introduces us to the world of polyrotaxones.
Rotaxone is a molecule which involves a long axle or dumbbell-shaped molecule, and then it has circular molecules that clip around it. These can be made into sort of molecular motors, for instance. But you can also make polyrotaxanes, which have multiple rings clipping around to the dumbbell. What this work from Fraser Stoddart's lab at Northwestern University in the States has done has made a really big polyrotaxane molecule, which has 20 rings around it.
Why is this a breakthrough? What's different or special here?
Well, the really special thing is actually that they managed to do it at all, or at least that they managed to do it with such good yields. They've managed to do this in one pot and actually get 90% yield out of it. This is a really nice introduction to dynamic covalent chemistry and looking at pi bonds, because the way that they've done this is they've used pi stacking. So each of these circular molecules has aromatic rings on it, and if they start stacking up, you get pi stacking and make much bigger, more complicated molecules and really start to think about really interesting applications. The original application that they were actually thinking of was to make molecular wires, using this pi stacking to make the molecules rigid, and therefore they could use them as molecular wires. And that's one of the things that Fraser Stoddart told me they're going to be looking at, trying to make self-assembling wires that they can then sort of start connecting up into circuits.
And why do they think the efficiency is so high? Why did they get the 90%? Yield.
So the 90% yield is, as I mentioned before, is to do with this pi stacking. But they think what happens is that the first ring snaps on and the second ring snaps on, and then it just starts to ramp up and up. So they think it's a sort of a stepwise process that you get one and then you get another, and then it just sort of zips up and it gets to a certain stage. They likened it actually to doing up your coat zip. So you start to do it up and it's a bit fiddly, and then you start to pull up the zip. And once you get to a certain amount and everything's aligning, it just zips up really quickly.
And off you go. And on the subject of wires, which you're saying is one possible application, something a bit like a wire, spider thread. Andrew, tell us about this breakthrough with regard to a molecule that's potentially one of the toughest materials yet made.
Yes, so this group has developed the strongest, or more specifically, the toughest fibres ever, they say. They don't know of anything tougher. We all know about spider silk. This is very tough. What they're interested in doing is recreating some of the toughness of spider silk, but doing it artificially. Spiders are very difficult to manipulate. It's very hard to get them to produce spider silk altogether for your purposes. So is it possible to mimic what they do synthetically?
So if you can't get spiders to do it, and you need a test tube to do it for you, what is the solution?
So the solution that Song Jong Kim and his colleagues at Hanyang University in Korea have come up with is to use a combination of graphene and carbon nanotubes. So it's this combination of something that is a kind of 2D sheet, which is the graphene, and a 1D strand, which is the carbon nanotubes. People have previously used both of these, but in isolation. And the carbon nanotubes in particular produce a very, very strong fiber. But carbon nanotubes are very, very expensive. And so you can bring the cost right down if you mix in some graphene. And as an extra benefit, the graphene actually makes it even stronger.
So if I were to zoom in on this with a really powerful microscope, having mixed together some flakes of graphene and some of these nanotubes, what would it look like?
What happens is the graphene flakes align, and it's that alignment that gives you the toughness. The definition of toughness is the energy needed to cause the material to fracture. The way these flakes are aligned, they deflect away the pressure on them, the force on them, and they deflect it into the sort of more squidgy polymer-type material, the matrix surrounding all of this, and as well the one-dimensional fibres that sort of coil and twist around the flakes.
So if you had a bullet coming in, it would be rather like the crumple zone on a car. You would turn all of the nice metal, which is in a straight line, into lots of ripples. Basically, the sheets of the graphene connected by the nanotubes do the same thing. They deform, and therefore the energy gets dissipated through the molecule.
Yes, it's that exactly. You want to take the force away from the impact.
So this is a proof of concept. The molecule is synthesizable, or at least this sandwich, this molecular sandwich, can easily be made. Is it practical to try and turn that into a bulletproof vest or something similar, though?
It seems like this fiber is pretty good in terms of practical applications. Obviously, when you talk about practical applications, it needs to be fine-tuned. So there's a range of different properties that you'd want. This group has focused particularly on toughness. But the fiber they've produced is flexible and it can be manipulated in the same way as you'd expect for weaving a fabric. At the moment, it's not very strong when you stretch it. And that's something that they want to work on in the future. With any of these kind of things, it's the combination of properties that will make it, something like this, a commercial success.
And is this a surmountable problem? What would they need to do to the recipe, or what would they need to add in order to get around this toss-up between strength and toughness?
Well, the combination of materials has got various elements. By varying those, they could probably change a wide range of characteristics. There's a polymer matrix that surrounds the carbon nanotubes and the graphene flakes. And then the ratio of the flakes to the nanotubes is something that perhaps they could alter as well. So there's probably a range of different things they can do by altering the components and their ratios.
Andrew Turley with the molecular equivalent of a chemical crumple zone. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, how scientists have made magnetic soap and the biggest metallic sodium in water experiment ever. 10 tons of the stuff. Before that, though, and on the subject of metals, here's a man with a detecting technique so sensitive that he can pick up metal ions glued onto antibodies in order to examine the biochemistry of individual cells.
My name is Norbert Czakowski. I'm working at the Federal Institute for Materials Research and Testing in Berlin in Germany. And here our main duty is to analyze metals at extremely low levels in industrial products or in the environment, but also in biosystems. And we have the most sensitive instrumentation at hand. One of these is inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry. And it is playing an important role for metal analysis. It allows us to detect metals down to nanogram per milliliter levels or even below.
Can you get a handle on, with this sort of technique, then, the question of whether all metals in all forms are all bad, or whether, as I think is becoming more clear more recently, some metals in some forms are bad, but the same metals in other forms, other oxidation states, may not be? Can you discriminate?
Yeah, I can give you a very nice example. About already 30 years ago, we have started to investigate chromium. Chromium-3 is an oxidation state which is essential for human beings and for animals and plants, but the chromium in the oxidation state 6 can damage the DNA, thus can cause cancerogenic effects and can cause mutations and can possibly also induce cancer. Thus, the one and the same element can have positive effects, so it is needed for our health, but another oxidation state of the same metal can cause, for instance, cancer.
How does this technique that you're using actually discriminate between these different oxidation states of the chemicals, which is enabling you to make these amazing discoveries that the same stuff can be, as you say, two-faced? On the one hand, quite nasty. On the other hand, absolutely essential for life.
For this, we couple our atomic detectors with special separation techniques, for instance, high-pressure liquid chromatography, which then are separating the species of interest. So we started at the beginning to learn to separate these toxic compounds. But later, we found a better way to investigate toxic biomolecules by using antibodies which are directed against specific compounds, metal-tagged antibodies. They can then measure these substances in the tissue samples. By just measuring a fingerprint of these biomarkers, we can identify if an organism is stressed by chemicals.
What about making diagnoses as well? Because if I were to hand you a histopathological slide, say a biopsy from a liver or something, yeah, or an organ where I suspected there may be cancer developing there, could you step cell by cell across that and then say, yes, there are signs and features in here whereby these cells in this discrete area are showing the characteristics of evolving a cancer?
So we are using here again the same trick. We apply antibodies which are tagged by a metal, and these antibodies are specific for a cancer biomarker. And then we can use a laser ablation system as a sample introduction system for ICP-MS, so for inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry, to measure the metal distribution in the tissue samples. And now we can apply many of these biomarkers tagged with different metals. That means we can measure many biomarkers at the same time in a tissue sample. This technology is so sensitive, we can go even into a cell. That means we can image a single cell. If we have only one metal per each biomarker, we have a poor sensitivity. But we can apply many tags per each biomarker, and this is amplifying our sensitivity. We have chemicals to add, let's say, 100 metals to a single antibody, and by this we are getting a gain in sensitivity by two orders of magnitude. If we now apply not atoms, but nanoparticles, gold nanoparticles, silver nanoparticles, we can amplify our signal by more than 6 or 7 orders in magnitude. And that means we are getting sensitivities we have been dreaming of for a very long time.
Norbert Jakubowski, how do you know what's in that pill you picked up at a nightclub? Is it ecstasy or something else entirely? Andrew.
So this is a big problem, detecting ecstasy. For various reasons, it's good to know whether the tablets that you have in your hand actually does contain ecstasy. For one thing, ecstasy is chemically very similar to a wide range of other compounds.
Amphetamines, that sort of family.
Yes, that family, which are also taken as recreational drugs or drugs of abuse. Now, there's lots of ways to detect ecstasy, but most of them are confined to the lab. So the challenge is to try and find something that you can take out into field work and very quickly and very simply work out whether or not ecstasy is present.
Is this so that the police, if faced with an individual with a handful of white pills in their pocket, will be able to say, ah, you're nicked because this is ecstasy? Or is it more that the average recreational clubber who wants to use this agent and isn't sure about its provenance wants to check that it is what the dealer said it was?
Well, the researchers who've done this work, Thomas Taroba at the University of Burgos in Spain, they won't have been thinking through exactly how all of this stuff will be used in the end. I think it's safe to say that it's in everyone's best interests that there's a simple and quick way of finding out what's in these tablets.
So how does it work? What's different here compared with those complicated lab tests that you mentioned?
Okay, so the breakthrough is that they found a fluorescent probe that they can put into a mixture where they've ground up the tablets or whatever form it's come in. You put it in a simple solution of some kind and you put the probe in, you shine some UV light on it, and it's going to fluoresce back if it's got ecstasy in it.
So the probe is a molecule which will recognise specifically and exclusively or not the ecstasy molecule and confer some kind of fluorescent behaviour under UV on it.
The probe will, with the right technology, be completely specific for ecstasy or MDMA. It isn't specific with the naked eye. It will fluoresce in the presence of other very similar compounds, but using a special bit of kit that detects fluorescence in terms of its intensity and the distribution of wavelengths that are there. And then you need to use some computer algorithms to crunch that data. But once you've done that, it'll give you a clear sign that whether or not ecstasy is in the material.
So what was the really tricky thing that the chemists here had to surmount in order to do this? Because it doesn't sound that tricky to come up with a molecule that will, bind to ecstasy and fluoresce in this way?
The breakthrough is the probe. Getting it to stick in the right way is very, very challenging. How these molecules position themselves and the structures they form in solution is a very, very complicated area. So getting something that you know is going to stick and then stick in the right way is very challenging.
I bet it's not as challenging as getting it off again afterwards, which could be useful in the next story, Philip, which is magnetic soap. Apparently it will clean things that other soaps can't reach.
Well, yes, Chris, but only if you've got a really strong magnet.
Well, who's done this and what is it?
So this is work that's been led by Julian Eastow at the University of Bristol in the UK. The idea is to take a surfactant molecule, and we're all reasonably familiar with surfactants. They're kind of tadpole-like molecules. They have a very polar head end, which likes water, and a more hydrophobic tail end that prefers to go into oily mixtures. So they tend to aggregate at the interface between oil and water mixtures. So that's what makes them good in washing powder or
detergent,
making emulsions and things like that.
They basically pull the grease off the pan and make it quite happily sit inside the water, the body of the water. So why do we need a magnetic one, and how does it work?
One of the applications that Julian's team are looking at is things like separating oil from water. If you've got a very finely dispersed oil in water, then you can put the surfactant in, it will organise itself around that, and then you could use a magnet to pull it out. I mean, we're not talking Deepwater Horizon scale oil spills, but you know, maybe one day, who knows? But
well, the Australian government, who are pretty worried about water, have a campaign to stop people chucking old engine oil into the ground, because they have calculated that you can bespoil about 1 million litres of water with 1 litre of engine oil if it goes into the ground. So I could see something like that actually would be potentially very valuable. The idea being you would put the magnetic soap in, it would grab the oil particles, grab them out with a magnet. What's the breakthrough, though? What's the chemistry going on here to make this possible?
OK, Chris, well, the crucial thing is to get your surfactant to actually interact with a magnet. And for that, you need something that's magnetic. The thing that I guess most of us are familiar with being magnetic is iron. So what they very logically did was add some iron ions to the polar head group of the surfactant. The problem is that a single iron atom on its own doesn't really interact with a magnet very strongly at all. I mean, it's not magnetic. What you need for magnetism is a lot of iron atoms that can communicate with each other, that they're held very close together. And that's where the other property of surfactants come in. If you design your surfactants carefully, you can get them to form very specific structures in solution. So these are generally kind of spherical or sausage-shaped, and they're called micelles. So all of the head groups will stick together at the surface of the water-air-oil mixture. The hydrophobic tail groups stick out into the oil, but that means that the head groups are all very close together, and the iron atoms in those head groups are then held close enough together to interact and talk to each other to have this magnetic effect.
Can you imagine all kinds of applications, engine oils and everything like that, for grabbing the water out of oils and cleaning up oils, extending their lives? Sounds absolutely brilliant, as I'm sure will be this month's trivia. What have you got for us?
OK, Chris, well, we've all either seen or, if the lucky of us, have done an experiment where you drop a small amount of sodium into a big trough of water. What do you reckon was probably the biggest version of that experiment that's ever been done?
I've seen some attempts on YouTube. I have to admit, people have actually managed to buy blocks of sodium, you know, a few hundred grams or something off the internet. I haven't seen anything more ambitious than that, though.
OK, well, in 1947, at the end of the Second World War, the US Army had 10 tonnes of sodium left over from various things that they were trying to do. And funnily enough, no commercial carrier would take it to distribute to other sources. So they decided that they wanted to get rid of it. And to do that, they would throw it in a lake.
With predictable consequences.
Absolutely. I mean, admittedly, they did pick a very specific lake that was already quite alkaline. It's called Lake Lanoir, which, funnily enough,
after
sits
after the washing softener.
Not quite, Chris. It sits between Soap Lake and Alkali Lake in the US. So that gives you some idea of the geology of the area. But they chose that lake because, A, it's already alkaline, and they realised that the extra sodium hydroxide that they produced would, even though it was going to produce 162,000 cubic feet of hydrogen, would still only raised the sodium content of the lake by about 4%.
And what happened?
Well, they had these big barrels and they pretty much just rolled the barrels off a cliff into the lake and shot them up with the machine guns a bit to make sure that they could get the water into them and sat back and watched the pyrotechnics.
And?
There was a very big display. Unfortunately, the hydroxide and various things that were given off stripped the paint off all the cars of the people who'd stopped by to watch, which the army then had to pay for as well. So if you want to see what the what this might look like, there is actually a video on our website on the podcast page.
And that's at chemistryworld.org/podcast if you'd like to check it out. Thank you, Phil Broadwith. And also thank you to the rest of the crew this month, Laura Howes and Andrew Turley, and of course our guests Norbert Jakubowski and Paul Kelly. The production was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Join us again next month when we'll be reacting to more cutting-edge chemistry. For now, though, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.